It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 2nd of July, 2011. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Village Butchery, 102 Oceanview Road, Onirua. On Saturday the 2nd of July, I talked to Eugene Bihankito from Peretahi Marae. I spoke to Brent Simpson from Waiheke Radio about his presentation at NetHui. And we talked with the opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight and Alex Stone. Coming up tomorrow at Peretahi Marae is an annual event to end to mark the end of Matariki and also the harvest of the kumara, which the Marae has become quite renowned for. And a lot of that was the work from the Kaumātua, the former Kaumātua, Koru Katu Kofata, and that work's been continued on by Eugene. Eugene's with us here today. Eugene Bihankito, welcome along.
Kia ora.
Okay, we'll just pull you in a little bit closer to that mic there, Eugene.
Okay.
Yep, nice and close, like you're eating an ice cream.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, so tell us a little about what the what's going on at the Marae tomorrow and why you're doing it.
First of all, just like to say ata mari to the whānau o Waiheke, te motu o Airaro, land of the island of the long sheltering bays. Come here in 89 to Waiheke, got involved with the Marae in 1990 and met this wonderful old gentleman, Koru Kato. Now, between Christmas and New Year this year, we unveiled our Kaumātua, our spiritual leader, and it's his third year passing. Now, he taught me how to grow the kumara for the people, and that helps the marae to put a bit of kai on the table when you have your manuwhiri, whether it be tangihanga, birthdays, or whatever it's down at the marae. We started with six boxes of kumara bought from Dave Tong when he had the greengrocers up in Onirua at the time. And from there, we had about 800 plants from those boxes. And we went on to end up growing about 8,000 a year by hand. But this year, it was Mark's, we put the stone on him. And his wish was always to teach the tamariki, our children, and the wider whānau of Waiheke. And I've gone out and enlisted the help of the Forest and Bird, Mr. Griffith and his lovely wife, and also Jenny and the Grow Group of Waiheke, plus our rangatahi from the island. And this year we grew about 3,000 kumara. We had a bumper harvest, and basically what tomorrow is all about is us coming together as an island and sharing the skills and the harvest and having our first kaitahi, meaning our first meal together, shared meal. So that tomorrow, and it couldn't have been done without the help of the community, with a lot of support, wide range, from the meat, from wild pork from Rob Morton down at Awaawaro. He kindly went out and caught us two pigs. The farm up on Waiheke Road there, they've donated a sheep, and also Dio Komato of mine, up the road here from Puhutukawa Lodge, John Dryland. He donated a sheep as well. And I got two more that was donated from Auckland, and also some brisket. So we've got enough food down there to feed at least 1,500, 2,000 people.
Well, that's a big lunch. Yeah.
So nau mai haramai, te motu o Waiheke, bring all your children down. We have games for our kids, entertainment from all our various artists on the island, and artwork that's been donated from a lot of our renowned artists around the place. And so we're going to have a art auction, a silent art auction, plus also raffles. One of the raffles would be jewellery donated from Pāwera Uarangi from up here in Onerua. And unfortunately he can't be with us because he's over in France finishing off a job there. So the team is busy gathering down there this morning, and right through the day into the evening we'll be preparing so that everything works like clockwork tomorrow. And it's going to be a fine day, and it's going to be a lovely day. Yeah,
excellent. Now that work with the Forest and Bird you've been doing, and with some of the youth on the island, is that ongoing? You're going to be continuing that?
Yes, we've got two paddocks, two sections in Eden Terrace that was donated for use by the Bailey family, I think that's the name of them, and they were an old identity on the island. And also 6 years ago Margaret Mills and her lovely man donated a bit of land up on Trigg Hill, which we are still using. The real purpose of this day is not only coming together for our crop, but also in the near future we are looking at standing our carvings up on the marae, and once they're up we're going to have a big opening, which but to facilitate the veggies and that from that, we need 6 acres. Currently we've got about an acre, just over an acre. We need 6 acres of veggies, which with the help of the community, and we should be able to achieve that. And with that comes a lot of education for our young ones, and for a lot of ones that have the skills to come together to create those gardens, the funding from this weekend will help to facilitate that. When we look at our opening, which my estimations maybe 3 growing seasons away, and if we have that chance of 3 growing seasons, then we'll be able to achieve that goal. And that'll go a long way to supporting our tūwhera, the opening of the official opening of the marae. When you look at Te Motu o Aotearoa or Kahu me Te Moimoi, Waiheke Island, all waka stopped here. And so what we have to do is karanga out, put the call out to the people of all those waka when we have our tūwhera. Then we have all the groups that have ever stayed down at the marae since its inception. We have to call out to them, put the notice out to them to come. Then we have our waiheke whānau, which is now 8,000 strong. We have to put the call out to them, so you're dealing with thousands, you know, and my estimations is between 5,000 and 10,000 people for that weekend. So yeah, it's a big job, and we're starting early because before the old man Kurukato passed on, he said to me, "Boy, don't be late, always be one step ahead of yourself," and that's the reason why we're here. We're trying to keep one step ahead of ourselves for this big occasion that is coming in the near future.
Excellent. Well, all the very best of luck for tomorrow.
Kia ora.
So people can come down from any time, what, late morning?
We start at 10 o'clock. Our pōwhiri is at 10. Please all come down. Bring all your children, grandchildren, grandparents, everybody. And we'll, as I say, we'll have food stalls down there. We'll have kids' games, music, and then the hangi. Then we'll have a short church service at 1 o'clock, led by our minister, Mr. Stead. And then straight after that, the hangi be served. And there's enough food there to feed between 1,500 to 2,000 people.
Excellent. I'll see you there.
Kia ora mai.
All right. That's Eugene Bihankito from Peretahi Marae, and their open day is tomorrow, Sunday, the 3rd of July. Over the last three days, Auckland has played host to NetHui, a conference featuring national and international presenters talking about the internet. And one of the people who presented at that hui was Brent Simpson, who's involved with Waiheke Radio, and he talked a little bit about the station and some of the things we're doing and some of our online involvement and engagement at that conference, and he's going to speak to us about that in a moment. So I suppose that the interesting thing, isn't it, Brent, is that, you know, you think of a radio station, but actually it's more than that, isn't it? We've got a quite a strong online presence.
Oh yeah, we've got a massive online presence, and one of the things I brought up during my talk at NetHui was, you know, you don't really have a radio station these days. You couldn't sort of function as a radio station without the internet, just on many levels, you know, just for even in internal communication purposes, and we've got sort of then in our external views, podcasts, streams, and so yeah, radio is something that takes place on the internet and with the internet, and so that made. Was an appropriate sort of place for me to talk about in that conference. Really interesting conference. One of the best conferences I think I've been to in quite a while. Put on by Internet New Zealand, who's a kind of a body that looks after sort of lobbies, government, etc., around internet policy and internet governance. So a fascinating mixture of people from all aspects of our society, really, not just sort of, I mean, business. There was business leaders there was politicians there, Cunliffe was there, Bill English spoke, many politicians, a guy, Gareth, can't remember his last name, Green Party List MP.
Hughes.
Yeah, Hughes, yeah. Really wide range of people doing community, NGO sort of work like us, and just a fascinating kind of... bit of a kind of a snapshot, really, of what's happening, the issues around the internet in New Zealand, and there are still a lot of issues, and there's a lot of, I mean, the conversation was rich, and one thing that sort of struck me from after day one is actually how continually pervasive and significant the internet is in our daily lives, and it's just becoming... It's not sort of plateauing off, you know. It strikes me as something that's still sort of cresting all the time. And with the broadband rollout that we've got coming, that's probably going to impact almost all institutions of our society even more than it already has. So these are the kind of conversations that we're going on the day.
So one of the things, and when I put the podcast up, I'll put the link to your presentation because you can watch the video of that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You pulled out a few statistics about the station in that, and quite astounding, really. I mean, because remember, we're talking about online here. So online streaming, 722 hours during this is the month of May, right. Wasn't it? Yeah, so 720 hours of online streaming, of which 225 were locally produced content or produced by the volunteers here at the station. That included something like 78 free community notice board bulletins, 36 What's On guides. There were podcasts and performances from your live musical performances by Waiheke Musical Acts. There were something like, what, 21 podcasts we're putting up every month.
Yeah, I looked at sort of quickly counted up the amount of podcasts we had on our website, and we've got about 625 podcasts in 2.5 years. And so if you divide that by however many months that is, it comes up to about 21 podcasts a month. And that, you know, I mean, and it's kind of funny because I was at the conference and there's lots of guys who were sort of, you know, coming. I spoke after Russell Brown, you know, and Russell Brown sort of got up there and he gave his numbers, and his numbers are quite huge. You know, we're doing 80,000 visits a month, and, you know, the internet sort of filled with these, you know, massive numbers, the Googles and, you know, and that. And so I kind of rocked along and was like, you know, we made 21 a month. But, you know, given that we've got only 8,000 people and just the sort of, yeah, I think given our numbers, and actually also not only the numbers of things, but some of the quality of some of the things, stuff that we're putting out, I think, on our podcasts that are kind of like little heritage documents for our island, I thought we did pretty well. And I got a really nice response from people who came. I was actually talking in a room that was discussing civic engagement. And so I talked about a project that we did last year, I think in October last year, right before the local community board elections. Some of you may have seen this. It was our sort of candidates page where each of the 15 candidates had a two-minute podcast, and then we set up a kind of a discussion forum commenting facility for them to engage with the candidates, and then we brought them back into the station and presented them with some of these questions. And I use this as just an example of how the internet and actually a community media platform, which is kind of what I consider the radio station to be, how it can really engage people in a kind of a democratic process. And it seemed to be, and for me, I was actually using this as a, you know, just a little case study of what, you know, some volunteers and a bit of open source software and a bit of initiative can from do for their community. And I mean, I felt that was a very valuable project that we put on, and we learned a few things, and I think that in the future we'll extend it and improve upon it. And so that's what I was presenting on in the day.
One of the things that I was fascinated about with this conference is that it was, I mean, the topic is so big. You know, to have a conference about the internet, it's kind of like having a conference about society.
What they did is, which was quite well, is they sort of divided it up into these certain streams, and I was sort of talking in a stream that was about digital citizenship. There was a stream about open governance and about how the internet is impacting governance. There was an innovation stream, and there was also kind of a few sort of businessy streams, but they tried to keep the they tried to tackle this by dividing it up into these fairly, you know, large but important themes, and I think they did manage to really draw some significant issues and out of these streams that are, you know, that are important for us to think about, and particularly organizations like Internet New Zealand. And the amount of politicians there was, although the politicians was a little bit disappointing because most of them are just sort of, you know, as politicians do, they rock up, give their speech, and then leave, where it's a little bit unfortunate that they didn't engage in it a bit more. So I'm hoping there's some way for some of the outputs to go forward. I mean, some of the people that were there, the Nikki Kays and the Gareth Hughes, did we say, you know, seem to be, they're kind of a new generation of politicians, you know, and they're all Facebook, they're people that are, that one of them was sort of saying that, I think it was Cunliffe who was saying that, you know, a politician's job before pre-internet worked on a 24-hour cycle. You know, you could do something and it wouldn't show up until the press till the next day, and so you sort of had 24 hours to cultivate a message or react to something, but now you sort of got to react immediately. And then some of the people like the Nikki Kays and the younger MPs, you know, they're just on Twitter and Facebook, and this is how they're kind of managing a sort of a relationship with their constituents. So that's going to have a massive impact in the future. And there were lots of one of the things that came out of the conference for me is that there's still lots of issues, you know, and they're moving fast, and they're sort of forcing our hand to change possibly more rapidly than what we may like. And and so there was actually a lot of confusion. I mean, it wasn't a conference where a lot of pieces of the puzzle all fell into place and everyone went away feeling like, oh yeah, we've got this all sorted. It was I think there was a lot of optimism, but there was also definitely a layer of, like, you know, God, how are we going to deal with all this? So it's quite fascinating. Had a fantastic speech by one of my heroes, Lawrence Lessig from the Creative Commons. I talked to him a little bit about low-power FM radio after the conference, so that was good for me. And, yeah, it was just a good day. Good, well done to Internet New Zealand for putting on an excellent conference.
Okay, so, I mean, the bits I've seen on the video, you know, a lot of it was videoed and online, so people grappling with some really big issues there about, you know, how you identify yourself online, anonymity, I can never say that word.
Yeah, anonymity was big. Yeah, privacy was quite a topic for a lot of streams.
And were there other, was it the opportunity to connect with other people who were doing kind of, you know, I mean, because, yeah, you get to these big players, but often it's the people doing the small innovative things that really kind of grab the interest and you think, oh, there's some opportunities.
Yeah. No, that was different. I mean, that was one of the, one more kudos to Internet New Zealand. What they did is they made the price of the conference, I think, $35. And so it wasn't prohibitively expensive for a number of groups who might not have the kind of, you know, the amount of money that it takes to send people to these conferences. I mean, you know, conferences go for like thousands of dollars these days. So there was an interesting group of people from the public sector, NGOs, people doing things like projects like computers in homes. And also, I found quite fascinating a lot of people working in the area of digital literacy, and that was quite an eye opener because I think, you know, I live online and I have for many years. I live in this bit of a bubble where, you know, I multitask and things just work relatively seamlessly for me. But after listening to some of the people working on what's called digital literacy, you know, the ability to actually just work a basic computer and then, you know, function online, still a lot of people out there who don't actually know how to do a lot of this stuff. And so if you are moving into a society where you're arguing that, you know, we have digital citizens and people are going to have to interact with all this open data that's coming out of the government and actually do a lot of more things online, we need these people to participate, and it's a big sort of a training problem, you know. And I was quite surprised at how the kind of numbers of people that actually still in New Zealand don't, like, someone mentioned there's 100,000 students in New Zealand that don't actually have access to computers still. And I just thought, man, that's unbelievable. And so those groups were quite inspirational, but, you know, had some important work to do if we are leaping forward into this this future. So that was, for me, an interesting slice of society that I hadn't actually, you know, hadn't really thought about in the way I, you know, the projects that we do and this whole sort of changing environment. So, yeah, very, very interesting. And then, of course, there was the big players. I talked to a couple of guys from Google, you know, and that. But yes, it's interesting times.
And it is, isn't it? And, I mean, we find this, I know, if you hark back to that thing you were talking about before, the thing we did with the election, that one of the, you know, and we've had this when we've tried to interact with the local board and so on as well, and they go, well, where can people hear you? And you go, well, you can hear us anywhere, because, you know, online. And people just don't, you know, and there's a whole kind of layer in society that's just not on their radar.
No, yeah, that's true, yeah. So I don't know what the answers to this are. I mean, there was sort of two camps. There was a design camp that said, we need to make things simpler. There was an educational sort of element to that. So those two things kind of coming together in this conference was interesting. And to have people who, I mean, okay, myself, you know, is one thing, but to have sort of businesses and these kind of high-powered, you know, brokers, you know, finding out that, you know, I can make all this stuff, but there's still this population that doesn't actually know how to use it, is was quite, you know, rewarding. And I think something was valuable in the conference itself. So yes, good time. And like you see, and if you want to you know, find out a little bit more about, if you're interested in the internet, you know, and you want to sort of have a bit of a voice in these questions, I'd actually encourage you to look up Internet New Zealand. And very, very reasonable membership as well to Internet New Zealand, $21 a year. Cheaper than Waiheke Radio, even. $21 a year to join Internet New Zealand and sort of have a bit of a say in some of the larger issues that are, you know, rapidly coming up around the internet. I mean, we've got the fast broadband schemes, like who's going to control this thing, how's it going to work, and there's also lots of open governance, like data is starting to be released by the government, so this has implications for people. So exciting times, and I'd encourage people to join Internet New Zealand. I think I'm going to join after the conference for sure.
All right, and I'll put some links to Brent's presentation on our Twitter and Facebook later on today.
Cool.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
It's the first Saturday of the month, so I'm very pleased to welcome along the opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight and Alex Stone. Good morning to you both.
Morning, Chris.
How are you? I think we've got a couple of opinions, as usual.
Excellent.
That's at least we got a fair bit of stuff to chew into this month, don't we?
Well, we have. And where are we going to start?
Well, I think, first of all, the interesting news that we got an earthquake last night. 9 minutes past 9. I must admit, I didn't feel it.
No, I know what I was doing at 9 minutes past 9, and I certainly didn't feel it.
We were... yeah, we had about 20 people in our living room, and the house tends to wobble at the best of times, even when the dog walks around the deck, so we wouldn't have felt a small tremor, but it was apparently 2.9. And
well, that's not much, is it?
It's not very much, and a lot of people tweeted about it, which, of course, had a lot of people in Christchurch going, well, harden up.
I know, you kind of feel a bit embarrassed about it, actually.
Oh, did you spill your coffee?
Yeah.
Oh.
I was in Christchurch last weekend, actually, and we went to sort of go talk to a friend of ours who needed a bit of support, but what I found... I didn't want to go into the central city to rubberneck, and missing that element of Christchurch, we sort of went out into the country, but on the way pulled in at a shopping center to get some groceries, and there was this very odd sense of normality. If you avoided the red zone, the rest didn't quite, or you know, it was kind of weird, but you can certainly tell the people are a little bit strung out all around there, so I do feel for them. Yeah.
But I assume a number of people must have probably felt it. It was quite close, apparently very shallow. It was only about 9 kilometres deep.
Oh, you mean our earthquake?
The one here. Yeah. And it was off Mission Bay, so really not that far away from us. So I'm sure had we been sitting quietly, we would have felt it. Funny how when you get earthquakes here, they always seem to come around that time of the night.
Yeah, and that
the
has
last
to
couple
be...
of ones we've felt here have usually been around 9 o'clock.
And that has to be a... straight out coincidence, you know. I don't think the earthquake knows what time of the day.
I wouldn't have thought so.
Because I have a friend that talks about earthquake weather. She reckons.
Yeah, well, that's Ken Ring's whole thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And that can that work? I don't know. No.
Okay, so you know, the earthquake, and let's bring it in local onto the island.
Speaking of Ken Ring and delusional things, let's talk about the art gallery, because has been hilarious.
Yeah, no, that's been a fantastic...
Now, we're also in the great position of being able to the first to talk about this, because, of course, the big meeting happened on Thursday night and hasn't been in the papers.
You'll hear it here first.
Now, you were at this meeting, weren't you?
Yeah, I was at the meeting. I'm a member of the gallery and have been for many years.
Yeah, so maybe we should just give a brief background. So, in a nutshell, we've had some controversy, conflict between different people involved with the gallery and the Headland sculpture about what kind of relationship there should be between the event and the gallery and the management structure of the exhibition and how that should be managed. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. But it's become clouded by personality, different points of view, and also kind of... the whole kind of an ownership imperative or an ownership assumption, which is quite an interesting kind of division here. The sculpture in the Gulf has always been run as a subcommittee of the main gallery, and some people are saying there's an issue with liability, that Sculpture of the Gulf is being a big event, if it falls over, could lose a lot of money and bring the gallery down, and vice versa. If the gallery falls over, then the Sculpture of the Gulf couldn't go ahead.
What I did find quite surprising about it, and I've been doing my best to try and follow all this over the last few weeks as this has been going, it was very hard through reading about it in the paper to gauge what sort of support the two factions had and how many people were involved in all this. So I was quite amazed last night when I found out that it was what a 230 to 27 vote.
You wouldn't have picked that up from the papers, would you?
No, you wouldn't.
That's the interesting thing. The group that they call themselves the independent group or whatever they're quite wealthy people, and in one way I sort of have been cornerstones of the event and have been hardworking members of the subcommittee. But with that came a kind of assumption that they owned it, which puts a strange kind of angle on community volunteerism, you know. And I think they made the mistake of not realizing the Sculpture in the Gulf has quite an interesting community of volunteers. There are a couple of hundred cheerful volunteers. And somehow this independent group seemed to think they were on their side, but it was very evident at the meeting on Thursday night that this whole community of volunteers see themselves as gallery volunteers.
So there were 260 people at this meeting.
No, there were about 150. What is the capacity crowd in the Artworks Theatre.
Yeah, 150. Yeah.
So it was full up, extra seats. That's
yeah, so this is proxy votes and that kind of stuff, isn't
there
it?
There were about 150, I think. I'm not sure exactly. Yes. Proxy votes.
Aren't they the kind of the refuge of the scoundrel?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the meeting had been postponed because a previous call for the meeting had been corrected on a point of order by the independent group, because the gallery had asked for proxy votes on a non-specific item. They said, we're just going to... The previous time they'd called for the meeting, they'd said, let's just discuss this issue, but you can send in a proxy vote, which was a bit odd. You can't have a proxy vote for something you don't know what you're voting for. So this time, at least, they had two motions. One motion was for a governance structure proposed by the gallery, which was setting up a limited liability company charitable status, almost exactly the same as the Clean Stream model. And the independent group wanted to set up a trust, which sounded like a reasonable idea to me. But if you looked at the structure of the trust, it looked like a power grab, in that the trust was made up of five trustees, three of which would be this independent group, and two others would be... So they immediately had power over the trust. You know, and I said at the meeting, look, if you'd be prepared to consider reversing that ratio of trustees, you know, it's one of those old things. You can amazing what you can do if you don't want to take the credit. You know, if you think you right, if it all hinges on you, then it's not quite right. So the trust could have been a reasonable, workable system, but it, because of these the way it was obviously set up to allow to be diverted by the small interest group. I'm being as diplomatic as I can here.
Yes.
It was obvious that the crowd wasn't going to vote for it.
Yeah. So what happens now? Is it toys out of the cot?
For these people.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what they do. You know, I wouldn't put a legal challenge past them. And a couple of the people in this interview.
Well, let's face it, they've got such a strong case, haven't they? You know, all 27 of them against however many it was. Yes, let's have a legal challenge, waste a bit more money on
this. Yeah, and a couple of the people in this independent group are landowners at pivotal sites along the sculpts from the Gulf. So it could be it could be a bit tricky to go ahead with the next show without the marquee on somebody's lawn. But then again, I would suggest the next time the Sculpts on the Gulf comes about, it goes on the northern headland of Maitea. There's another walkway there. And one of the artistic problems with the Sculpts on the Gulf this year was a little bit of same old, same old. Some of the sites were reused by the same... No, now we're talking different things, an artistic thing. But some of the sites have been reused in the same way. So if we used a new walkway, it might give it a fresh look. And that might neatly sidestep the issue of these landowners who feel they're no longer part of it. So we don't know how they're going to respond. Yeah.
It is always interesting, though.
Hopefully there'll be goodwill from their part.
With things like these. I mean, it was quite surprising, actually, to see the normally reticent Gulf News actually covering this, because normally they're quite cowardly when it comes to covering disputes within local communities. They do tend to shy away from that. Well, but this one, they did seem to think, hey, okay, we'll cover this.
Yeah, well, the Marketplace didn't cover it at all. So that was an interesting thing. Yeah.
I mean, the Marketplace is... They seem to have given up on local stuff.
But this is the biggest bun fight since the local board, isn't it?
Yeah. It's been a very interesting drama, you know.
But I think the thing that is interesting, though, is that we do tend to think of ourselves on Waiheke as being a very artistic community. we have this little delusion that this island is sort of humming with artistic endeavour. But when you get right down to it, when the actual numbers are seen... And I mean, I speak from experience here, having done theatre here over a number of years. And people often wonder why theatre groups tend to have a fairly limited lifespan. Because I think you get to the point where it sinks in and you finally have to admit to yourself that when it comes to doing anything really serious in terms of theatre, anything with long words in it or things that would require an attention span, there's really only about 300 people on the island that are interested. And once they've come and seen the show, that's it. You're playing to audiences of three or four.
Yeah.
And it all becomes a bit depressing after that. Yeah. And here we are watching this enormous fight over several weeks where we sort of feel like there must be enormous numbers of people involved. And yet it all boils down to less than 200 people are actually care about this.
The demographic,
and that is basically the island's artistic community.
The demographics of it are really quite interesting. And I've seen a shift over the past few years. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. The gallery has grown quite markedly in its membership. When I arrived here, it was, I don't know, 50, 80 people. It wasn't a big membership. But that was 15 years ago. The gallery now, I think, is the single biggest community of interest on the island. I think they've got about 400 members and emails for all of them. So I think they've just pipped the golf club, because the golf club was the single biggest email list on the island.
Yeah.
Now, the gallery with its 400 members, what I've noticed is the gallery membership is growing to much more sort of how would you describe them? People with an interest in the art, patrons of the arts, but not active artists. So on Thursday night, for instance, with 120 people in the Artworks Theatre, I could recognise about 5 artists. So there were 5 artists interested enough to go and debate this thing. So there were 115 people who were these non-artist people, non-practicing artist people, should we say. Yeah. So that's quite an interesting shift to it. And to go back to Alan's point, if we call ourselves an artistic community, we've still got to remember those artists are the fellas that count, you know?
Well, yes, and let's be honest about it. It's not like Waiheke can really boast that many fantastic artists. Yeah. You know, for every genuinely talented, inspired, witty and intelligent artist on this island, there's another 99 frauds, bores, sudes, and people who've gone off their meds and think they're Pablo Picasso. It's the same. It's the same with music and pretty much anything else artistic. Yeah. There's a lot of wannabes who, between them, produce an incredible amount of amazingly dull output.
Yeah.
But then you get the one or two people who are really good.
This could lead us into a whole new avenue of debate, because I think the wannabes are as important in a way. Without the wannabes, without the hope, without the dream that there is some artistic importance in what they're doing, there is no imperative, you know. There's no
but then it's that old thing about everyone has the right to be heard, no one has the right to be listened to.
That's right.
And there are a great many people producing stuff on this island that is really fairly valueless.
My
personal turning point with the art gallery came was the day I went in there and found myself looking at a number of blank canvases. They were different colours, admittedly. It wasn't like they left the canvases completely blank. Paint had been applied, but it was all the same colour.
Yeah.
And somebody in there asked me what I thought, and obviously I delivered I delivered my fairly bracing views on what I thought of people who just produced blank canvases, and it turned out the person asking me was the artist.
Oh, good at him.
And her. And so I
him or her.
I was treated to a great long condescending lecture about, well, of course, yes, it is a bit challenging if you're still hung up on representative art.
Yeah,
and so as far as, you know, bores and sudes and things go, I rest my case.
You know, it is a and speaking from the other side, I find the whole it's a hard road, mate, to try and push the line of non-figurative colour field painting. It's still difficult to get people to understand what you're on about. Yeah. And you're right.
Yes. I mean, was funny. It was funny when the first kind of people did that back in the 1950s.
Yeah. What's interesting is those kind of shows. It's 50 years ago, and even now, you know, painters like Yves Klein and stuff, or Ed Reinhardt, who did the plain black canvases, if they show them now in big sort of supposedly civilized cities, those canvases get abused, attacked. There's still anger about them, and it's 50 years ago. You know?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot of they are challenging, shall we say? Yeah.
All right. So that's the art world debunked. So
now on to sport.
Yes. Go on.
Yeah. What sport?
Because yes, the interesting stuff about the preparations being made on the island for the great cargo cult that is the Rugby World Cup. Will it deliver? Interesting question.
Because I think we're depending so much on overseas visitors, and with the way the world economy is going, and Europe might be a little bit dodgier in a few months' time, and who knows whether all those people will come.
Yeah. Well, this figure of 90,000 visitors is being bandied around quite a bit. Are we really going to see 90,000? And if we do, will they have spent all their money on their plane ticket and we'll be sort of staying in backpackers and eating fish and chips?
Well, have you seen the price of accommodation? I mean, the Auckland accommodation prices are getting up over $1,000 a night. Wow. On those weekends of the big games.
Yeah. But there seems to be a lot of this agonising and hand-wringing going on about, you know, are we being good hosts? Are we milking this excessively? But isn't that what every city does when they host this event? Or any event?
Yeah.
I don't know, where was it held last time?
So what about the island? I mean, there's been a meeting of businesses who've said, oh, there's a Rugby World Cup on, perhaps we should, you know, sell Rugby World Cup related things and try to make a few bucks out of it.
Yeah, which all seemed like a lot of waffle, too little too late.
Yeah, and it also could be, you know, there's a certain market size in this country that doesn't shift. So if you... It happened, so when those big sailing races arrived at the Viaduct Basin, they were all busy for a while, but basically they just took business away from the restaurants in Devonport and the restaurants in the rest of town.
Well,
so one place looks busy and the other place suffers. And I think it might be a case with the Rugby World Cup. Okay, we'll have the visitors, but then some, like establishing this party central, it'll be a big piss up there, but some of the pubs in town won't have their piss ups, you know. So it's a mobile thing. You don't please everybody. And it's not a cash cow forever. Yeah.
Maybe we could have a sweepstake on the drowning tally of Party Central.
Oh, people falling off. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a little underwhelmed by it all. It's, you know, why get so excited about this game, which is really quite odd, you know, the blokes all sticking their heads up under each other's bums, you know. It is so last century.
Yes.
So last century. It is so it's so last century, you know. Okay, fair enough. You know, for me, it's really, really rich in bizarre humour. And I'd like to maybe pursue this bizarre humour line by, you know, what if we all went and... What if the biggest crowd went to the worst game? If it was Uzbekistan versus Portugal or something, you know. You know, it would just show it up for... It is a bit silly. They talk about this World Cup, but it's a sport where basically, what, 5 teams can win? There are only 5 contenders, really, you know, which puts our quarterfinal performances in perspective. You know, it really, if you analyze the Rugby World Cup, 5 or 6 teams can win, and we've gotten to the quarterfinals for the last 2 goes. So let's get a measure of... reasonableness about this whole thing.
Because I do have this awful feeling that we're on one hand, we're looking at we're going to have this fantastic cash cow for a month or so, and there's going to be this great money flow coming in. But what about afterwards, when the tourists have gone and we're left with huge rates increases to pay for all the infrastructure put together for a mere 4 or 5 weeks' worth of absurdities that not all of us are interested in.
And all the hospital bills for the fine young athletes that have been maimed for life.
Yes. I was reading the other day,
or the women that have been beaten up at the, you know, the day after the team loses. You know, that really bugs me.
Oh, yeah.
For me, the elements of it that are quite distasteful. There's a celebrity function, I think it's this weekend, or is it next? It's about this time where people are paying $100 a ticket to go listen to an interview of Graham Henry, who's not the most sort of sparkling interviewee I've ever come across. And the interviewer is Tony Veitch, which says a lot about the, you know, there's elements of this of the culture that's a little distasteful.
It is extremely distasteful.
So that's the kind of celebrity this game produces. Let's say, yeah, it's a wider thing. It's a cultural thing that is not entirely healthy, I don't think. It's a game. Let's not take it too seriously. Let's laugh about it, but let's not turn it into a... let's not let the dark side of it be overlooked. It's not great.
Yeah,
I can't get terribly excited.
Yeah, it's a horrible business. I admit, all right... If Scotland won a game, I'd sort of feel on a bound to get a little bit excited about that. But, I mean, they're not going to get anywhere. So
I like the ideas of minnows. Is that the word for such big fellows? But, you know, if Samoa won a game, that would be fantastic.
Well, you'll be thrilled to hear that there are plans developing for artworks-related rugby-themed activity in conjunction with the Cup.
Yeah, there will be.
Yeah, so the gallery will be in there. Yeah,
show.
Yeah.
And, I've got some... satirical sculptures out there, which are giant scrum machines, which are impossible to push. It's the whole sort of commentary about the mythology of manhood. And yeah, I've been doing a few things artistically about the World Cup, but I think it behoves us to take the whole vision of this thing with a dash of satire, and most people aren't. Most people are taking it far too seriously.
Oh, yeah. But sport is always taken far too seriously.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. We shouldn't take it too seriously.
But speaking of the, you know, another of the dark sides of the, of these things, I was reading the other day, the city of Montreal has finally paid off the last of its massive overdraft from the 1976 Olympics. Go Montreal!
Well,
it only took you 35 years.
It's an interesting angle with Montreal, because Montreal was a very unsuccessful Olympic due to the presence of New Zealand. And it's one of the hidden things about our sort of self-made history that we forget. New Zealand arrived at the Montreal Olympics at the same time where there was a rugby tour, and African nations boycotted the Montreal Olympics because of the All Blacks' connection with the Springboks, playing rugby with the Springboks in their part of the era.
I did not know that.
So that is one of the reasons why the Montreal Olympics was such a fizzer. There were no Ethiopians running or whatever. And, you know, it was our fault.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, mind you, we were there.
Mind you, you know, that was 1976. I just discovered beer and girls, so...
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't really taking much notice of sport.
No, we're talking about the serious stuff.
But, you know, but, but it's amazing to think that, you know, that, what, 34 years on, or 35 years it's taken them to get out of debt.
Yeah.
Just from a month's worth of...
Yeah, they check it events.
Stupid, but you say, hop, skip and jump.
So you say the most important things in life are beer, girls. I would have added poetry. For me, they're the most important things.
Yeah, poetry's pretty good.
Yeah, it's up there. There are some things that are seriously important. You know, this is how I spend my days, thinking, what's the first line of the next poem, dreaming about the important stuff. I'm not kept awake about... whether Portugal will beat Uzbekistan at the Rugby World Cup.
No, nor me. I just can't wait for it to be over, because the level of sheer boring drivel that we're going to have to listen to over the next couple of months is just going to be close to unbearable. If my job wasn't so tied in with the whole thing, I would tidy the house up, put it up for rent, and head off and see a friend of mine in Texas, where I'd be guaranteed never to hear anything about rugby.
Yeah, but would you want to rent your house out to a bunch of rugby yobs anyway?
Well, I've got to admit, you know, last time when the British Lions toured, I was very proud of the Brits who came over. They were well behaved, obviously looked like they were having a great time, and I thought they were a credit to their country.
I'd just like to go back to your point about boring drivel. You know, I was just thinking this morning about the stuff that constitutes national and international discourse. You know, the one that's overnight is the story of the mother-in-law in Devon.
Yes. That was hilarious.
Is that banal, or is that a commentary on what creates...
Oh, you're going to have to fill me in on this one.
It's a great story. I'm with the mother-in-law. Where do you stand on this one, Alan?
I'm with the mother-in-law.
Yeah. That's an international story. It's all over the airwaves. What happened is a young bloke from London wanted to bring his betrothed, his fiancée, to the country, to the family farm in Devon, and the young woman met the mother-in-law-to-be, who happens to be the stepmother of the young bloke. And after the weekend in the country, they all went their separate ways. This young couple went back to London, and the mother-in-law sent an email to this young woman pointing out her lack of manners. And the email drips with sort of snobbish condescension, but the behavior it points to about the young woman also points to some fairly basic deficiencies. But this young woman, instead of just being corrected by her elder and her future mother-in-law, sent this email out to her friends, and it's like all over the world. It's viral. It's on the web. It's on the front page of the Saturday paper. And it's kind of amusing essay on what constitutes real communication or stupidity, you know?
Yeah, because it certainly did come across like this young woman was a fairly rude, self-obsessed and boorish creature.
Yeah, yeah.
But the mother-in-law did sound like a real snob.
Yeah.
I think both of them deserved a smack around the head in that case.
But for me, the interesting point is this is what we're talking about. It is a level of banality about it, but it keeps us talking. But like Darth Thompson and the EMA, you know, it's also kind of
sick. Oh, the Alistair Thompson.
Sick of listening to that or yeah. What?
Yeah.
We better just talk about it briefly, though. Just
Well, for me, the ultimate irony was he was uncontactable yesterday because he's away sick.
Yes. What was it, Alistair? Time of the month? Dear. But I think this... I was getting quite irritated listening to all the howls of outrage. I mean, look, this is the problem with freedom of speech, that stupid people are allowed to have it. And this, since this man clearly is extremely stupid, he said a stupid thing. Yeah. But now everyone's going, oh, but he shouldn't be allowed to say that. Well, no, he is, really. He's permitted to say it. Well, but he should lose his job.
Well, he works for the people who...
why stop there? Maybe he should be put in prison. Or better still, why don't we have him put to death for saying something that offended some people?
Yeah,
grow up, I say.
Where would we be if no one said stupid things?
Well, let's, you know, and throwing this one at you, because we didn't talk about this before, but on the freedom of speech angle, there's all this controversy about the book, about, what's her name, Maxina Kahui.
Yeah.
And all the booksellers saying, no, we won't stock it.
Yeah, for me, the writing of the book and trying to sell the book is not the major tragedy. For me, the tragedy is that is how that family, everybody in that family, went to the right to silence, and how the trial became a farce. That for me is the tragedy. That the two kids died, and this family closed in, and no one could say. There was just no ethical sense there. The book, I don't know. Yeah, once again, the book is a freedom of speech thing, and I think the library had it right in yesterday's paper. They say, look, we stock books, and we stock books that not everyone agrees with. Yeah, so I don't think the book is the problem. I think the problem is the culture that led that entire family to close ranks and claim the right to silence.
Mm.
That's how
it was a ghastly business.
Yeah.
Yes, again, this strange thing that when somebody is saying something that certain people take offence to, that it's like, no, they have to be silenced.
Yeah.
We can't have this. Well, no, leave it alone. It's freedom of speech. It's not always nice.
And whether reading Maxina King's story is going to clarify anything...
I would doubt it very
because
much.
Because she, you know, with due respect to her, she doesn't appear to be a... switched on person.
No, well, she hasn't written it, has she? I mean, I presume she's been interviewed by Wishart.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's an irony, isn't there?
But her worldview, how much is her worldview going to make our world a better place, or make it safer for kids? It's not going to help much, I don't think.
I mean, there's an irony that that the way that people call for these voices to be silenced is because now people have this amazing access to voice their opinions through things like Facebook.
Yeah.
But at the other side to that is we all have our ability to voice our words and you know, become instant celebrities on our own little YouTube video or whatever, but it becomes ever more ephemeral. You know, maybe Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame has now gone to... You know, what's it, a 30-second clip on YouTube and you're gone, you know. If you're stupid or have nothing of valid relevance to say, you're gone, you know. You have your little moment and that's it. There's nothing more than that. So there's no real substance to the ability to have short-lived celebrity, maybe.
And on that note... Your 15 minutes.
That's our 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah. No, wait, we'll be here next week.
Yeah, thank you very much. The Opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight and Alex Stone. And they will be back on the first Saturday of next month here on Island Life.
We should be just about into the whole rugby.
I don't know, 70 days away.
70 days away, all right. Well, we'll definitely have some updates on how the island's business community are readying themselves for the absurdities.
Yeah, well, let's not just, you know, it is going to be a talking point, but let's find a more interesting angle on the whole thing.
Jobs.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Really?
We'll see. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.